Well, good afternoon. Good to see you. I get the privilege of being the last session, I understand. I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm thinking that's bad. It's after lunch. It's the last session. Okay, you know, I'll do the best I can, but I'm not promising anything, all right? I like the name tag thing. I think name tags are a great thing. If we all wore name tags all the time, we'd probably be a friendlier world, right? But we had an embarrassing thing happen. I was doing a Willow Creek conference in England. And we printed up everybody's name tag in advance, like yours, you know. We put the first name real big so people could greet each other and their last name kind of smaller. And people came and they got their name tags and they went into the session. We thought everything worked real well until about halfway through the first day. And this woman came up to the registration desk. She was all upset. We said, "What's wrong?" She said, "My name has been misspelled." And we're thinking, you know, big deal, lady. You know, you didn't say that, but we're wondering why she was so upset about it. We said, "What's your name?" She said, "My name is Sylvia." And sure enough, in our name tag, we'd spelled it saliva. She was spitting mad, I'll tell you that. I just got back from Saddleback. You all were at the conference, I guess, earlier, and I was speaking on the Da Vinci Code. So the movie opens tomorrow, and I'm sure you have or will be doing something in your church to respond to that. I know 67% of pastors say they are going to do something. And if in the Q&A time we want to talk about that a bit, we can. But I came to talk about a broader topic, of which the Da Vinci thing is sort of a subset, and that is evangelism on purpose. How is it that we can create congregations that are contagious with the gospel? What can we do as church leaders to engender the kind of an atmosphere within our church where it becomes normal that people reach out with the gospel of Jesus Christ to their friends and neighbors and colleagues and family members? And the verse that I put on your notes is one you're all familiar with, from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16, where Jesus said, "You're the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people put a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." So we have Jesus exhorting us to live lives that are salty, lives that make people thirsty, in other words, for the truth of the gospel. And to live lives that are like light, that illuminate things, that shine Christ's light of compassion and hope into a world that's been darkened by sin. So, you know, how can we do that? Well, you know, I think personally what Jesus was doing there, he was inviting us into what I like to call the unexpected adventure of evangelism. I call it the unexpected adventure because you never know what's going to happen. If four things are true of you and your congregation, if you're motivated to share Christ with others, if you're available to do that, if you're prayerful and if you're prepared, you never know what happens on what starts out to be an average and routine day, how God might ambush you with an opportunity for personal evangelism. And sometimes it doesn't work out like we think it's going to. I had an embarrassing thing happen in the South not long ago. I was at a conference I was speaking at with my ministry colleague, Mark Middleberg, and we decided to go one of these Cracker Barrel restaurants to get some breakfast the next day. So I don't know if you've seen these places, but what they do is they have rocking chairs on the front porch so people can sit in them and kind of people watch. So we're heading toward the door of this restaurant, and we notice there's two rocking chairs, and in the first one's a young woman about 18 years old, dark hair, dark eyes, guy sitting next to her, and we realize we got to walk right in front of him to get the door. Well, it's just fine. So we're walking along, and just as I walked in front of this young woman, I heard her say, "What's a deist?" And I thought, I just wrote a book about that. So I turned around, and I looked her in the eye. I said, "A deist is someone who believes that God created the universe, but then he walked away. A deist is someone who believes that God is distant and detached and disinterested. A deist believes that God sort of wound up the universe like a giant clock, and he's just letting it tick down." But I said, "That's not what the evidence shows." I said, "The evidence, for instance, of biochemistry shows God's continual involvement in the life process beyond just the initiation of the universe. And then you have Jesus entering into human history, and you have the resurrection." I'm talking about science and cosmology and physics and biochemistry. I'm talking about history. I'm talking about all this stuff. And her eyes are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I'm just going after it. And finally, I turned to Mark, and I said, "Mark, I can't believe it. We happen to be walking past." And she said, "What's a deist?" And Mark said, "Lee," she said, "Buenos dias." I wish that were a joke. That is exactly what happened. But you know what? The ice had been broken. At that point, how could we not get into a spiritual conversation? Turned out she was there with her boyfriend who was on the state track meet, and they were there for the state track meet, and she took us back to the hotel room where all the other team was there and the coach was there. We ended up talking about Jesus for about 45 minutes. So you never know what started out a routine and average day, what might happen. We got into a spiritual conversation. I remember I was an atheist for most of my life, and at the Chicago Tribune, I was a legal editor, and I lived kind of a wild life as an atheist, and then came to Christ and came into the ministry. And so I wanted to take a couple of elders from my church downtown Chicago to show them where I used to hang out when I was a legal editor of the Tribune. So I took them to the federal courthouse where I covered all the major trials in the city, and we went up the 21st floor where the press room was, and the elevator door opened up, and there, standing in the hallway, I recognize this guy from all the years previous who had been a competitor of mine from another news organization. And he had known me back in my wild living days as an atheist, and he hadn't seen me in all these years. But he recognized me too, and he said, Strobel! And he's a tough guy. He's one of these Chicago reporters. He's got the cigar, but you don't light it, you eat it, you know. And he's got the pork pie hat. And he's a tough guy. And he looks at me, Strobel! How the blank are you, son of a blankety blank? I said, I'm doing real well. How are you doing? He said, I'm doing good, but I haven't seen you in years. He said, you still writing for that blankety blankety Chicago Tribune, that blankety blankety piece of blankety blank? I said, well, John, I've actually had a big change in my life. I've become a Christian and I'm a pastor now. And he looked at me. It was like cigar almost fell out of his mouth, and all he could say was, well, I'll be damned. And I said, well, John, you don't have to be. And God gave me a chance to share the gospel with them. And I said to the two elders, I can't believe this. It started out as an average and routine day. Who would have known that we would have an opportunity to talk about Jesus to this guy? I remember after I became a Christian, I was assistant managing editor of a paper in Chicago area. And it was the end of a tough day, and I was getting ready to go home, and I just had one of those promptings from the Holy Spirit that I should go into the business office of the newspaper and share Christ with an atheist friend of mine there and to invite him to our Easter services at Willow Creek. I just felt led to do that. And I thought, gosh, if God's really leading me to do this, something wonderful is going to happen. This guy's going to come to faith right now. It's going to be great. So I went over to the business office and I looked around. Didn't see anybody but my friend sitting there. Perfect. So I went up and said, hey, Bert, how you doing? He said, I'm doing good. I said, hey, you know, Easter's coming up, and I know that you're an atheist. He said, yeah, I am. I said, I know, but, you know, there's really good evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. He said, yeah, I don't care about that. I said, well, I know you don't, but, you know, we got a tremendous church, and I think if you came with your family, it'd be a wonderful experience. He said, I'm not interested in going to church. I said, you ever think about spiritual stuff? Never. Ever think about God? Never. Have any questions about Jesus? Nope, not one. He shut me down. I'm sharing the gospel. I'm talking about Jesus. I'm inviting the church. Nothing. And then I started to get embarrassed. So I said, well, you know what? If you ever have a question or something, you know where I sit, so I'll see you later. So I went out, and I thought, what was that all about? I mean, you know, and for years I thought, what was that about? Because he's, to this day, he's an atheist. And I thought, well, maybe I was just a link in a chain that's eventually going to lead him to the Lord. I don't know. But then several years after that, by then I was a pastor at Willow Creek Church, and I had just spoken on a Sunday morning, and I got down off the platform. A man came up to me who I didn't know and said, could I just shake your hand and thank you for the spiritual influence you've had on my life? I said, that's very kind, but who are you? He said, well, let me tell you what happened. He said, several years ago, I lost my job. And I didn't have any income, and I had a big mortgage, and I thought I was going to lose my house, and I was really scared. And so I called a friend of mine who was publisher of a newspaper. I said, do you have any odd jobs I could do? I need some money. And he said, well, can you tile floors? And I said, well, yeah, I tile our bathroom. I think I can tile floors. He said, well, if you can tile some floors, we have some work for you, and I'll pay you, and it's great. So he said, one day, not long before Easter, I was in the business office of the newspaper, and I was on my hands and knees behind a desk in the corner working on some tile on the floor, and you walked in, and I don't think you saw me there, but you start talking about Jesus to this guy, and you start talking about the resurrection, and you start inviting him to church, and this guy wasn't at all interested, but I'm on my hands and knees, and my heart's beating fast, and I'm thinking, I need God. And he said, after you left, I called my wife, and I said, we're going to church this Easter. He said, you're kidding. I said, no, we're going to church. We went to your church. I came to Christ. My wife came to Christ. And our son came to Christ. And I just wanted to say thanks. And I thought, you know, here's a new form of evangelism, ricochet evangelism. You know, you share Christ and it bounces off a hard heart and you never know where it's going to go. It's a, This to me is the unexpected adventure of the Christian life. And when we have congregations who are living out that kind of life, what they realize is all aspects of their life take on a new dimension. Their worship becomes that much more heartfelt because they're worshiping the God who loves their spiritually lost friend even more than they do. It's when their Bible study becomes that much more relevant because they're not just looking for abstract theological truths. They're looking for something they can help to connect with, to share with their friend. It's when their prayer life becomes that much more rich and dependent on God because they realize apart from the work of the Holy Spirit, apart from God using me, there's no way I can bring about a conversion in anyone. It's when their whole life as a Christian gets ratcheted up. And they begin to live out this unexpected adventure, and it becomes contagious in the church. And it gets to the point where the church, the air is almost carbonated with excitement because there's so many stories of new people coming to faith. The problem is this. It ain't happening in most churches. Let's be honest. It ain't happening. I mean, right now, according to Tom Rainer, who does a lot of research in this area, it takes 86 church members working for 1 year to reach one person for Christ. It takes 86 Christians working for a year to lead one person to Christ. This is a losing proposition. Listen to what Tom Rainer's an optimistic guy, if you know him. He's a great guy, does a lot of this kind of research. But listen to what he said. He said, the numerical evidence seems clear. The American church is dying. We are not reproducing Christians. American church growth is typically the transfer of members from one congregation to another rather than the conversion of the lost. And that's reality. I mean, evangelism has got to be at the heart of our ministry. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 16, telling the good news is my duty, something I must do, I am compelled to do. And the Bible says we're to be imitators of God as dearly beloved children. Jesus' mission was to seek and save the lost. That's our mission, is to be his ambassadors, to help bring about the conversion of our neighbors and friends and colleagues and family members. So how do we do it? How do we do as church leaders? How do we create congregations that are living on the evangelistic edge? How do we create congregations where the unexpected adventure is being lived out in individual lives? I think there are some things we can do to help our people be salt and help our people be light. My ministry colleague, Mark Middleberg, condensed this down into a book called Building a Contagious Church, which I highly recommend because it encapsulates much of what I'm going to talk about today, because it's really what Mark and I did when we were heading evangelism at Willow Creek Church in the 1980s and early 90s, actually through the 90s. And it's sort of six stages that you can go through as a church leader with your church that I believe will transform any church into a church that is living on the evangelistic edge. Whether you're charismatic, whether you're mainline, whether you're, it doesn't matter. Liturgical, doesn't matter. Because they're biblical principles. And I think, you know, as I look at this problem that Tom Rainer talks about, the death of the American church, the fact it's dying, the fact that we're not fulfilling the Great Commission, and I go, what's going to change that? What is going to change it? I'm putting my eggs in these six stages I'm going to talk about, because to me, they're biblical, they make sense, and every time I see church leaders implement these in a church, I see the evangelistic passion go up. What else? If anybody's got better ideas, I'd like to hear them, because I want to get behind your ideas. But this, you know, this is one thing to consider in terms of how do you transform your church. Six stages. The first stage is this, and it's in your notes there, an outline, I believe. First stage is this, and I know you've been talking about these kind of core value issues, but the first stage is leaders must own and model evangelistic values. They must own and model the value that spiritually lost people matter to God. I think one of the main reasons our churches are not evangelistic today is because its leaders are not evangelistic. The values aren't being embodied by the leaders of the church. Listen to this from Tom Rainer. He did a survey last year. Says, quote, over half, 53% of pastors have made no evangelistic efforts at all during the last 6 months. They've not shared the gospel. They've not attempted to engage a lost or unchurched person at any level. They have become busy doing many things, but they have chosen through their lack of actions to be obedient to Acts 1:8, Matthew 28:19, and many other clear passages of evangelistic mandates. That, to me, is the nub of the problem. Speed of the leader, speed of the team. Your church is probably never going to be any more evangelistic than you are in your personal life. You will probably set the high water mark for your church in terms of evangelistic opportunity. And so how do we do that? How do we first own and model that value that lost people matter to God? Well, I like to propose a little measuring test that we can use on a regular basis to kind of measure the gauges in our life to determine whether or not we're embodying this value or we're not. And I mentioned these four things earlier, MAPP, motivation, availability, prayer, and preparedness. So I'll just walk through these. The first thing is motivation. Our motivation to share Christ with others always fluctuates. Let's be honest. I mean, there are days when, you know, the Bible says, you know, God doesn't want any to perish. And yet there are days when I wake up and I've got a Muslim neighbor and I've got an atheist brother and I've got the guy at the dry cleaners who's from Pakistan. I don't know what he is. And you know what? A lot of days I don't care. God doesn't want any to perish. But some days it's okay with me. I got other priorities here. I got deadlines to meet. I got ministry to do. You know, let's be honest, our motivation fluctuates. And so I think we have to take stock on what is how's the gas tank on your evangelistic motivation and evaluate that on a regular basis and say, what are some things we can do when we realize I don't feel motivated personally? And I realize speed of the leader, speed of the team, unless I'm engaged with evangelism, my people aren't going to be. So what do we do? Well, I think there's some things we can do to up that motivation level. The first is to ask God to give us a heart for lost people. You know, James says you have not because you ask not. And I think to confess it and to say, God, I know it's sin, but right now I don't feel motivated to personally reach out to lost people in my life. I don't. And I confess it and I ask you, Lord, please give me your heart. Give me your perspective toward lost people. I think that's a prayer God loves to answer. I think we can go to the Gospels and we can soak in the teachings of Jesus afresh and read them in a new translation or a new paraphrase. It kind of puts a new, you know, a little spark in it for us. We've read this stuff so many times. But allow those passages of Jesus' heart for lost people to do something new in our hearts. I like to hang around with contagious Christians. I have certain people in my life who are so contagious in terms of their faith that if I just schedule lunches with them, Mark Middleberg is a great one. I meet with him once a week. He always fires me up for evangelism. And when he's down motivation-wise, I fire him up. It's a mutual thing. And I've got others in my life, Bill Hybels and Rick Warren and others, who I know if I just get together with them, I'm going to walk away with fresh motivation in my heart to reach lost people. And to say when they talk about action evangelistically in their lives, that inside me, I'm saying, I want that kind of action. I want that too. What do I do? What do I need to do? Another thing is to read biographies of contagious Christians. I love doing this. D.L. Moody, man, I love that guy. I just have read so much about D.L. Moody because he motivates me by his love for lost people. It just increases my motivation level. I was reading another book that's a great one to read. It's called Amazing Faith. Anybody read that book? It's the biography of Bill Bright. I read that book. I got so pumped up to reach lost people just reading this story. And there was one particular story in that book about a survey that was done among college students to ask these college students, in your opinion, how does one become a Christian? And they did a survey and they found out that 97% of college students had no idea how a person becomes a Christian. And the book describes a young worker who took these findings to Bill Bright. And this is what she said. As he looked at the survey after survey after survey, Bill Bright said, "They don't know, they don't know." And he put his head down and he just sobbed for the longest time. She said, "All my life, as I thought about Bill, I thought, that is the heart of that man." And I read a story like that. I said, I want to be so motivated to reach lost people that I sob at the news that 97% of people on our college campuses don't know how to become a Christian. And reading about these people fires me up. So, you know, when you notice that your gauge is down on your motivation, to say, what can I do? Who can I bring in my life? What can I read? What can I study? What can I pray that can increase my motivation? Second thing is availability. Availability. So often we get insulated in ministry. And I think the single most important thing a church leader can do to increase the evangelistic effectiveness of their congregation is for that church leader to build one authentic, deep, caring relationship with a hell-bound pagan that you become best buddies with, and you go to the movies with, and you go to the golfing with, and you go to his son's sporting games, and you go to, he comes to your daughter's piano recitals, and you hang out together, you go on vacations together, because eventually you say to yourself, wait a minute, I love this guy. He's a lot of fun, and he's bright, and I care about him so much, and he is headed for hell. What can I do as a church leader to create an environment at my church where my church can help me to reach my friend for Christ? Now there's a new motivation. And now when you preach, you're not looking at abstract information about what non-believers are thinking. You've got a friend. You know what he thinks. You know what his priorities are. You know what his objections are. You know what his obstacles are between him and God. And you can then write your sermons to meet those objections. My brother is an atheist to this day. And when I write a sermon that's going to be preached at a church where there's going to be an attempt to reach non-church people, I don't write it for a faceless mass of people. I write it for my brother Ray. And I'll pick up my pen and I'll say, point number one, blah, 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 blah. And then I put my pen down and I say, what would Ray say to that? I know exactly what Ray'd say because he's my brother. I know him. I know him inside out. So I pick up my pen. I said, some of you are thinking, yeah, but what about blah, blah, blah? Well, here's what the Bible says about blah, blah, blah. I just write it for my brother. So I know if my brother is an atheist, if I can reach something to reach him who's far, so far from God, I can reach all kinds of people who aren't quite so far as well. So I got to spend time with them to know that. I got to devote time to making myself available to our relationship so that my motivation increases and my understanding of the non-church mindset increases. Now, you don't have to add a whole bunch of new opportunities or activities into your life in order to do this. I mean, nobody here has got an extra 3 hours a week, right? That you're looking around going, what can I do? I got 3 hours. I got nothing to do. None of us are like that. So I'm not saying here's a new activity for you to do. Go build a relationship with someone who's far from God. You can invite that person into activities that you're going to do anyway. You're going to watch the NBA playoffs. Why don't you just invite your non-church neighbor to come and join you and watch it together? You haven't added 1 minute of time to your life. You haven't, you know, you're going to do it anyway. You're going to wash your car. Call them up, say, bring your car over. Let's wash them together in the driveway. You're going to play golf anyway. Why do you always play it with church leaders? Why don't you invite your non-believing friend? You're going to play anyway. You're going to go to a movie? Invite them to go. So you're not adding anything to your time, but you're spending time with your friend to deepen a relationship so the spiritual conversations might flow and that you can understand his thinking process as you chat between commercials or whatever. And then I'd say accountability is important. You know, I check my calendar at the beginning of every month, and I look at it, and I look, and I say, how many lunches do I have on my calendar with non-church people this month? And if I don't have any, I get on the phone. Say, hey, we haven't talked for a while. Let's get together. Let's have lunch. You know, so, you know, check the calendar once a month. Have someone in your life like I do with Mark Middleburg. We hold each other accountable on this. Who are you reaching out to? Are you building relationships? Are you stretching yourself? Are you taking risks for the gospel? And we encourage each other and pray for each other and hold each other accountable. Without that, the value just kind of seeps away. So are we available? Third, are we prepared? Are we prepared? Doesn't mean we're educated. You can be a theologian of great renown and be unable to share the gospel in a simple, effective way with a lost person. I remember when I was at the newspaper, and I went, after I became a Christian, I went on to India. I was part of a ministry in Southeast India that reached out to the rural communities there, and we did medical stuff and evangelistic stuff. And so I went to India, and I came back, and people said, hey, I know you took a lot of slides. Why don't we have a lunch hour where in the conference room you show your slides from India, and we'll have a bag lunch, and that'll be fun. So, okay. So I did that, and I showed all these slides, and the last slide showed us baptizing some new believers in the Krishna River. And I just mentioned, I say, okay, we run out of time. That, so those are some people who are just became Christians, and we're baptizing them in the Krishna River. Okay, put on the lights. And I looked, and I got like 3 minutes to go before we have to leave. And I'll never forget this one reporter named Pete raised his hand and said, Lee, I got a question. You said those people became Christians. What do you mean become a Christian? How do you become a Christian? What does that mean? And I realized I had about, 2.5 minutes left to explain the gospel to him. And I was thankful that somebody had trained me to be able to succinctly, simply, but effectively communicate the gospel to a guy like Pete. I could have, PhDs in theology and not be able to do that. But when we're not prepared, when we don't feel confident in sharing our faith that way, we shrink away from those kind of opportunities. But when we're ready, not to just know all the theology behind it, but to know how to engage with people and to bring them across the line of faith, then we're more willing to engage in it. The last P is for prayer. I mean, are we praying consistently and fervently and specifically for lost people in our lives? I mean, you think of Jesus on the cross. It's interesting that the prayers of Jesus for spiritually lost people continued right up until his final breaths on the cross. Because the imperfect tense of the Greek in the description of the Passion of the Christ tells us that Jesus didn't just say it once, but he kept repeating it over and over again while the spikes were being driven through his hands, while the spikes were being driven through his feet. Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. So his prayers for lost people continued right up until his final gasps on the cross. So on what basis? I love the way John Stott puts it. He says, so on what possible basis can we justify not praying specifically and fervently and consistently for lost people in our lives? And yet sometimes we give up. We stop. How many people do you have in your life who you used to pray for? And you stopped because you sort of made the decision for them and said, they're never going to come to faith. And you sort of mentally crossed them off. I've done it. Those are the perfect people to give a call to and say, man, we haven't talked in a long time. Let's get together. Let's talk. Let's renew our relationship. Because often it's a person who's we like and we used to have this great relationship with. For some reason, they've kind of gone to the periphery of our lives. We stopped praying for them. But I mean, when we can get people praying in our churches together for lost people. We started this thing at Willow Creek that we got from South Korea called the 111 Prayer Movement, where about 8 weeks before a major outreach event like Christmas or Easter, and we did this at Saddleback too, where we would get all our people together and say, let's all agree to pray for one spiritually lost friend for 1 minute at 1 o'clock every day between now and, say, Easter. And one of the things to be praying for is that you'd have an opportunity to invite them to come to the Easter service where we know a gifted evangelist is going to be explaining the gospel, that you'd have the courage to invite them and they would be receptive. So, one guy said, can I pray for two people at 2 o'clock for two? No. One person, 1 o'clock for 1 minute. And it really knit the church together. On this mission, we were all in this together. Everybody at 1 o'clock would stop all around the community. They were part of this church and just pray for that 1 minute for that one person in their life. I remember we actually gave people a little card with a 111 on it and the name of the person they're praying for, to write it a line where you could write it. And we said, this is for you to remember to pray for that person. Don't show it to the person. This is for you. But we had one young woman who took it and she wrote down the name of her friend and she showed it to her friend, said, look, I'm praying for you. You, one person, for 1 minute at 1 o'clock every day, because I love you. And I want you to meet Jesus and know him the way I do. And her friend said, okay, yeah, thanks very much. Appreciate that. No problem. Within 2 weeks, that unsaved young woman who was being prayed for was in her shower getting ready to go to work, getting dressed, ready to go to work in her shower. And the Holy Spirit just seized her soul at that moment as she got on her knees with the water cascading down and prayed to receive Christ. I love it. It was American efficiency, you know, a conversion and a baptism at the same time. I just thought, does it get any better than that? But we had so many, but it gave the church a common mission. Everybody can pray for 1 minute, but when we do it all together at the same time, praying for the same end, we began to see those kind of stories, how God was working. Then we created a website and we'd put on those stories and we'd encourage other people. But are we praying for lost people? You know, I understand that people have free will. I get that. And I understand that prayer is a mysterious thing, and I don't understand a lot of the how it works and so forth, but I'm just naive enough to believe what James says when he says the prayers of righteous people are powerful and they're effective. And sometimes that's all we can do is pray, right? What else can we do? I prayed for my father-in-law, who was an atheist, for over 20 years, virtually every day. And he didn't come to faith until the last cogent conversation of his life before he died. And I wanted to give up on this guy 100 times. But what else could I do but pray? He wouldn't listen to me. I like the way Mother Teresa puts it. She said, when I pray, coincidences happen. And when I stop, they don't. That's all I need to know. When I pray, people come to faith. I don't get it. I don't understand it all. I just know when I don't pray, nothing happens. So are we praying? So those are 4 things I think we can assess in our lives. Our motivation, are we making ourselves available? Are we prepared? Are we prayerful? To say, where are we at as leaders? Speed of the leader, speed of the team. Your church will not be most likely more evangelistic than you are. So use that as a way to ratchet it up when that value, as it does probably faster than any other value, just leaks away. Okay, we spent more time on that first point than we will on these other ones, so don't panic. Second point is this. Leaders must instill these values into the congregation. We own them and battle the values. We need to instill them into the congregation. Often, we as church leaders don't challenge our people in terms of evangelism because we're not living it out, and we feel hypocritical, and they know we're not. And so we shrink back. But when we own and model the value that lost people matter to God, then with confidence and courage and sensitivity, we can inculcate that value in the congregation to help them see that there is nothing more exciting than living on the evangelistic edge. So you can do this in little ways as you lead the church. You can let it leak out in the prayers that you pray. You can let it leak out in the casual conversations you have with the elders or the board members before a meeting. You know that, golly, here's something, it's a small deal, but I've been going every morning on my way to work, on my way here to church, I stop at the same bakery to buy a muffin from the same guy every morning. And I've been kind of building this little relationship now for about 6 months, and today I asked him if he would come to Easter services. And he said he'll think about it. I know it's a small thing, but I just want to say, yay God, you know. You just leak it out that way, and people, what goes on in people's minds? Wow, that's great. What am I doing? Am I building those kind of relationships? Am I taking those kind of risks? When you tell those simple stories, people can relate to that. If you're always telling stories about how, you know, you led the whole first class in the airplane to Christ and all that stuff, people can't relate to that. Say, yeah, that's you. You're an evangelist. You're a pastor. Of course you can do that. I can't do that. But when we can tell simple stories, I took a risk. I shook a hand of a stranger and got into a conversation with them. Simple things that anybody can do. Then other people say, I can do that. And why am I not doing those kind of things? But in our leadership, we let it leak out wherever we go. Anecdotes and illustrations and messages that we do to intentionally bring in evangelistic story that can encourage people, but can also help them understand that evangelism should be normal in the Christian life. It is not normal to be a follower of Jesus Christ and not have a desire to reach out to lost people. That's not normal. And if our goal is to be fully devoted followers of Christ, then normal ought to be that we have his heart toward lost people and his desire to reach them. And we have to let our churches know. You know, if you go, Bill Hybels used this illustration. He says, you know, you go to airports. Many of you have flown in here from a place. And you go to the airport. If you don't see planes taking off and landing at the airport, you say, something's wrong. This is an airport. There should be planes taking off. There should be planes landing. You immediately know something is wrong if planes are not taking off and landing. In a church, it is normal for the church to have a heart for lost people. It is normal for Christians to be eager to share their faith with people they encounter. It is normal for part of the church's values to be to create programs and ministries and services and events to assist us in reaching out to people. That's normal. And if that isn't happening, something is wrong. And we got to teach our people that. Number three, leaders must empower a point person to lead the evangelistic charge. Leaders must empower a point person to lead the evangelistic charge. I got a friend named Carl who's a businessman, and he was talking to my buddy Mark Middleberg and I once, and he said, you know, I can sum up for you in two little things the whole success, the whole key to success in business. Really? Yeah. Absolutely. Two simple things. If you do two simple things, you will be successful in business. Well, what are they? Number one, keep your customers happy. Number two, get more customers. You do those two things, you will be successful. And then he turned and he said, now, who on the church staff is in charge of new business? Who is laying awake at night, dreaming, praying about ways that they can tap into new people in the community who've never set foot inside your church before and to bring them in? Here's the truth. If you're the senior pastor of a church, you've got a lot of values you have to inculcate in your congregation. That lost people matter to God, that community through small groups is a biblical way of doing life together, of prayer, of worship, of Bible study. You have all these values you have to hold up. You could spend 3 weeks or 4 weeks on a series to encourage people in evangelism, but when that series is done, you got to go preach another series on worship or on prayer, on small groups or something else. And what happens? The evangelistic value goes down. You can't do it all. And so I think the missing link here is a point person, a staff person or a lay person who has a special relationship with you as a senior leader, who you have empowered to lead the evangelistic charge at the church, who is your right-hand man or woman who is going to lead this and these initiatives in the church. Now, if you think about who that might be in your church, you're probably thinking about the wrong person. Because every church has an evangelistic Eddie, you know, or evangelistic Bob. And they're just nuts for sharing their faith. And they are out taking all kinds of risks and doing wild things. And people look at him and go, yeah, that's Eddie. He's weird. But God bless him. He's leading people to Christ. I can't do that. You know, let Eddie do it. That's not the person you want to be your evangelistic point person. He may be a great evangelist. Go encourage him and send him out. That's great. But you need a leader. You need someone who will have the respect of the congregation, who is a strategic and a tactical thinker, who can be your peer, who you can relate to in maybe a different way even than other staff members or other volunteers. Where your hearts are knit together for this goal of reaching your community for Christ, and he has your confidence or she has your confidence, and you stand up in front of the congregation and you empower that person. This is the person who's going to help me lead the evangelistic charge in this church that all of you are going to be part of. And we elevate that person and give them the credibility with the congregation that they need to be able to take on that mantle. But without that, you know what? It's not going to happen because you can't do it all on your own. You've got too many values that you have got to lift up. Now, what does this guy do? What is this guy or gal who's going to be your evangelist appointment? What are they going to do? These are the next three steps that we're going to talk about. They kind of head this up. Step four, leaders must train 100% of the congregation to share their faith naturally and effectively. Both words are important. Leaders must train 100% of the congregation to share their faith naturally and effectively. And this is one of the things your point leader does is he coordinates the training of everybody in the church. And he gets up and says, guess what? We're going to do some evangelism training. And if you just checked out mentally because you're thinking that's not for me, then it's especially for you. Because we're going to help you discover who you are and how God can use you in a natural way that syncs up with who God made you to be to reach out and effectively communicate the gospel to people in your sphere of relationships. The problem in most churches is that pastors try to turn other people into little mini-thems. You know, they think the way that they do evangelism is the way everybody ought to do evangelism. Right after I became a Christian, I was in a church in Missouri. And I was in a Sunday school class there at the church. And at the end of the class, one of the leaders of the church said, you know what, this afternoon, I'm going to go door to door and knock on the doors of strangers in the neighborhood and try to lead them to Christ. And if you all love Jesus, then you'll join me. And I thought, I love Jesus. I don't want to be knocking on some stranger's door and asking them to go to, I'm sorry. You know, it's not me. He was good at it. He was good at it. And he thought everybody therefore ought to do it. And so many pastors are these bold and confrontational kind of guys or gals. And so they think everybody ought to be that way. And all the introverts are saying, not me. Is there another way? And yes, yes. We can be ourselves and God can use us. The Bible has many examples of other styles of evangelism. The Contagious Christian Training Course that Mark Middleberg and I put together with Bill Hybels. By the way, new edition of that just about to come out. Is all about people discovering their style of evangelism and affirming that so that we unleash them to be themselves. The Bible talks about a confrontational style. We have Peter in Acts 2 who gets up and he says, y'all just murdered the Messiah. What are you going to do about it? Well, that's Peter. Peter was a bold person. He wasn't trying to be something he wasn't. That was Peter. He was cutting off ears in Gardens of Gethsemane. You know, that's who he is. So he got up and he confronted people. But we're all not like that. Some have the intellectual style, like Paul in Acts 17, who reasoned with the idol worshipers and the philosophers in Athens. And some are apologists. Some like to give evidence for their faith and reason with people and persuade people. Well, we ought to encourage them to do that. If he had done to those philosophers what Peter did in Jerusalem, it would have been a disaster. But God used who Paul was. He was a brilliant guy to connect with people there. Some have a testimonial style, like the blind man in John chapter 9, who Jesus healed, and then he's brought before the religious leaders. What does he do? Does he confront them? No. Does he reason with them? No. He says, look, I was blind and now I see. Go deal with it. He shared his testimony. And some people are really good at that. And they can connect with people and build a common bridge and then share their faith and share their testimony in a way that God uses to bring them to faith. This is my style. I use a combination of the intellectual and the testimonial styles, and I basically go around the world and I just tell people, I used to be an atheist, and here's how I live my life as a result. Then my wife became a Christian and encouraged me to check out Christianity. These are the facts I encountered that convinced me that Jesus is the Son of God who proved it by returning from the dead. This is how I received him as my forgiver and leader. This is how my life changed. That's all I do. And God uses it. That's what my books are all about. That's my talk. That's what I do. I'm not a confrontational guy. You may be surprised by this, maybe not. I'm an introvert. I overcompensate by doing this kind of thing. I don't like it. I've never spoken at an event in my life where I would not have gladly given back 5 times the honorarium not to do it. I don't like speaking in public. I'm an introvert. But I do it because I know I have to do it to help people, you know, get on board with things that are important. But I'm not a bold, confrontational guy like Peter. I would have wilted if I had stood up in front of that crowd of 3,000. But I can tell my story. I can do that. Other people have a relational style, like Matthew in Luke chapter 5. Matthew becomes a disciple. The first thing he does is throw a party. And he invites all his tax collecting buddies to get together with Jesus and the disciples, knowing that as they got together in a relational sphere, sparks would fly, spiritually speaking. And some people are like that. They're very relational. They're good at building a lot of relationships and sharing their faith. Some are invitational, like the woman at the well in John chapter 4, who realizes this is the Messiah I'm talking to. And what does she do? She goes in the town. Does she confront people? No. Does she reason people? No. Does she share a testimony? No. Well, she invites them. Come hear this guy. I think he's the Messiah. And they came, and some came to faith as a result. And some people are really good at inviting other people to come to evangelistic events and concerts and so, to bring them to places where a gifted evangelist is going to be communicating. And some have a serving style, like Dorcas in Acts chapter 9, who would, you know, make clothing for the widows of the neighborhood, and that quiet act of servanthood, of sacrificing her time and energy and resources on behalf of other people, is a powerful way, especially in this postmodern culture, to connect with non-believers. Some people have that serving style. We ought to encourage them not to be something they're not, but to be all that God made them to be. to serve people through their serving. We had a woman in our church named Julie Harney. And Julie was a housewife, had three kids, introverted, quiet. Never in her life had shared her faith. And she came to the Contagious Christian Training course at Willow Creek, taught by Mark Middleberg, who was the point person at Willow Creek. And she learned, I don't have to be like Lee or Mark or Billy Graham or somebody that I can never possibly be. I can be me. And she realized her style is relational. Even though she was an introvert, she loved building one-on-one relationships with people and get them some piece of pie and have them over to the house and share their lives together. And we said, God can use that, Julie. You can be you, and God can reach people through you that way. And at the end of the first year after that training, Julie Harney had led 14 people to Christ. Just in her quiet, introverted, let's have a cup of coffee and a piece of pie together. Friends, how many Julie Harneys are sitting in our churches saying evangelism for somebody else? It's not for me, and I'm not good at it, and I'm not the kind of person to go door to door, and I can't give out tracts to people, and it's just not me. And they need to know that's okay. Here's half a dozen styles. There's others in the Bible. Let's find which one resonates with who God made you to be, and let's unleash you to be you. And God will use people that way. So I think we need to train everybody in the church how to naturally and effectively share their faith. And the course that we use is the Contagious Christian Training course, because it does emphasize that we're all different and we can be who we're made to be. Fifth thing we need to do, I think, is that leaders must unleash those who are gifted or passionate about evangelism. There's a certain percentage of your church, maybe 3 to 7%, that are spiritually gifted evangelists. And they are passionate about it. God bless them. We need to encourage them to continue to do what God has called them to do. They are going to have a disproportionate impact. You know, I'm a gifted evangelist. That's what I do. My wife is gifted in a different way. She's more of a, her ministry is to mentor women, Christian women, one-on-one. She's more of a shepherd that way. And God bless her. It's wonderful. I'm going to lead a lot more people to Christ because that's how God wired me up. Then she is going. That's okay. But I'm going to have a disproportionate impact evangelistically in my church. So we ought to be identifying these people and saying, how can we maximize their contribution? Here's what most churches do. They find out who has a spiritual gift of evangelism or passion for evangelism, and they segregate them. They bring them out of all the ministries they're in, and they get them into a little evangelism ministry. I think that's a mistake, because now you've isolated them from the rest of the church. Instead, the model that Mark and I pursued at Willow Creek was to say, let's find out those people who are passionate and gifted in evangelism, and let's keep them in the men's ministry. Let's keep them in the women's ministry. Let's keep them in the children's ministry. We need them there because they're going to be the sparks that encourage other Christians in all those settings to be more evangelistically active. But we know that evangelist types have their motivation go down time to time too. So we would have 4 times a year a meeting. And we would have a breakfast meeting on a Saturday morning, and it would be a storytelling time. We'd bring in an evangelist who would give a little talk. It was just a time to encourage them, to motivate them, to let them tell stories about evangelistic adventures that are going on. And they would come out of these meetings fired up. And then we'd send them back to the men's ministry, back to the women's ministry, where they would be the embers that would light these evangelistic passions in all those different settings. We need evangelists among our children in the men's and women's ministries and elsewhere in the church. Let's not segregate them where they're ineffective because they're only talking to themselves now. Let's bring them together periodically, fire them up, and send them back so they can, you know, have an influence all over the church. We call it the frontline team at Willow Creek. And those meetings, I mean, all you got to do is get evangelists together is telling stories, and that's all you need. They'll be high as a kite in 20 minutes. So we're going to train everybody to share their faith. We're going to encourage those who have the gift of evangelism by these periodic meetings to fire them up and send them back. And then finally, number 6, leaders must create safe places where Christians can take their seeking friends to hear the gospel. Leaders must create safe places where Christians can take their seeking friends to hear the gospel. The most congregations, what they do is their approach to evangelism is, let's kind of train people how to share their faith and let's send them out. God bless you. Let me know what happens. and they send them out. Now, for those 3 to 7% who have the spiritual gift of evangelism, that's no problem. They can take a person who's an atheist, lead them to Christ. I mean, they can do that. God's gifted them to do it. It's no problem with them. I have a friend named Jay. Jay is a gifted evangelist. The only way you will be able to stop Jay from sharing his faith is to put a bullet in his head. That's it. Short of that, you're not going to stop him. You know, he was once trying to make a left-hand turn on a four-lane highway in Chicago in the rain, and traffic was coming both ways, and it was real heavy, and he couldn't get his car. There was no brake in the traffic to pull out. Finally, a bit of a break, he slams on the accelerator, shoots out into traffic, and his car starts spinning down this four-lane road. And cars are skidding and trying to stop to avoid hitting him. One car went into a ditch, and everybody stopped. And he got out, and thank goodness nobody crashed into anybody, but then he saw the car that went into this little ditch. So he went over to the car, and he got in the ditch, and he opened the car door, and there was a woman behind the wheel. And Jay said, Are you all right? And she goes, yeah, I'm okay. And then Jay said, now if you had died just now, are you confident you would have gone to heaven? And Jay told me, I said, Jay, but that's who he is. You cannot stop this guy from sharing his faith. So, you know, for 3 to 7%, send them out. That's great. The problem is that leaves over 90% of your church sitting on their hands in the congregation because they say, I can't do that. That's not me. So what we need to do, I think, is to work in partnership with our individual church members as church leaders to create safe environments to help them in their evangelistic endeavors. To say, we'll create a safe environment where you can bring your seeking friend to an event or a service or whatever, where a gifted team of people in music and drama or the arts or whatever and a gifted speaker can communicate the gospel and help you to reach them for Christ. Now, there's different ways that churches do this. A few of them, like Willow Creek and Saddleback, have weekly services, seeker-sensitive services designed to, you know, minister to Christians, but primarily as an opportunity to bring your non-believing friend to come and to hear the gospel with you. Some do it weekly, some do it monthly, and say, we're going to do, like I have a friend in England, he has a church, and they have a thing at their church called First Sunday. And they know the first Sunday of every month is the time that's a seeker-sensitive service. It's the one, if you're building a relationship with a non-church person, bring them to that service because we're going to help you to, you know, reach them for Christ. So some churches do services like that. The second category of safe places that churches are creating, and to me, this is the most exciting development in the last 10 years in the church, is what I call seeker small groups. It's little safe enclaves where non-believers can come to build relationships with their Christian friends and over the course of time to go through a curriculum or an experience together where they can meet Jesus. Small groups designed to reach spiritual seekers. We started these in the early 1990s at Willow Creek. Today, there are over 1,100 non-believers who are part of these little groups. And we've been tracking them through the years. And what we found is, for every of the non-believers who join these groups and stay with them, 80% come to faith in Christ. 80% conversion rate. Where else do you get something like that? And this, in a postmodern world where people are looking for experience, where they're looking for connectedness, for relationships, to invite people into an opportunity to get to know each other, to go through an experience together over time, to meet Christ. And you can do this regardless of your church. You don't have to have a seeker service. It doesn't matter what your church style is. Every church can have seeker small groups. One of the things, they talk about Da Vinci Code, and I talked to some guys here who are actually using this stuff. I went over to England and to France to personally investigate the allegations in the Da Vinci Code, and we created a small group curriculum called Discussing the Da Vinci Code, driven by a DVD that shows us at the Da Vinci Code sites. I interview scholars and experts, and it's a fun experience. Four-week design. Christians, sure, that Christians can go through it, and it'll help them to be able to respond to it. That's fine. But the real reason we did this is so Christians can invite their non-believing friends to join them. You've seen the movie or you've read the book? You want to get together and talk about it? Oh, yeah, that'd be great. So there's a discussion guide. They don't have to have any pre-knowledge because the DVD drives the whole thing. And you can get together and talk about the Da Vinci Code. And we, what we did is we designed the discussion as a way to really engage people to eventually lead them to that personal understanding where they come to the point of realize Jesus really did claim to be the Son of God and really did prove it by returning from the dead. And so they walk through this experience together. And man, these are just, these groups, I'm so excited. If you want how to do these groups, how to implement these groups in your church, one place you can go get everything you need. It's a book called Seeker Small Groups by Gary Poole. Has everything in it. You can just read that book, tell you how to do the whole thing A to Z. But, you know, it's not that you have to be the Bible answer man or the Bible answer lady. It's not that you have to be a brilliant apologist to run these groups. Because you know what? The secret of these groups is it's not the apologetics that leads people to Christ. It's the relationship. We had a woman at Willow Creek, real obnoxious woman, frankly. And she would admit it. And she came up to me one day. She said, I'm going to join one of those seeker groups you got. Really? Yeah. She said, yeah. I said, that's great. She said, no, you don't understand. I'm going to join the group just to cause trouble. I'm just going to ask all the embarrassing questions and watch the Christians squirm. Well, good for you. I'm glad it's somebody else's group. That's good. So 6 months later, we're doing a baptism service. She comes up to me to be baptized. She'd become a Christian. I almost fell over when I saw her. I said, what in the world happened? Last I saw you, you were going to join this group to cause trouble. And here, I'll never forget what she said to me. She said, the two Christians that led my group loved me even though I was obnoxious. And when I couldn't make it to group one night, they called me and said, we missed you. You want to get together for coffee? And when I was sick, they brought me chicken soup. And they cared about me and they opened their home to me and they listened to me and they valued me and they validated my seeking process. And it was their love that brought her to faith. And that's what we see. The questions are just, the discussion is just an excuse to get together. And often there are issues that they need to deal with. But so often it's that relationship that God uses. So there are curricula that are available for these. I did another curricula, just came out, called Faith Under Fire. I used to have a national TV show on the PAX network called Faith Under Fire, where we would have Muslims and Hindus and Christians and agnostics and atheists debating hot topics like the resurrection, the Trinity, things like that. So the show is off the air now, but we took the little debates that we did and we created a small group experience. So you watch a little debate between, say, an atheist and a Christian over the resurrection, and then you play a little segment, and then you have a discussion time, and then you watch a little more, and you discuss it some more. And there's four-week curricula that we created out of this called Faith Under Fire. So that's one. But you know, a lot of these groups don't even need a prepackaged curriculum. Because what they do is they get together, and I'll tell you in a minute how they do that. They get together, get to know each other a little bit, icebreaker questions. And then before they break up the first night, the leader says, let me just go around the table and ask you just to be honest and respond to one question before we go. If you could ask God any one question and you knew he would give you an answer, what would you ask him? Bob, what would you say? Bob says, I know exactly what I'd ask him. Where was God when my wife died of cancer? Bob, thank you for sharing that. Let me write that down. Nick, what would you say? Nick says, you got the Bible, you got the Quran, you got the, how do you know any of it's reliable? Okay, great question. Mary, what would you say? Mary says, I'm a scientist. Can a person be serious about things like science and still be a Christian? Okay, good question. You go around the room, you get that, and then at the end, you hold up that piece of paper and you say, friends, that's our curriculum. Bob, we're going to talk about your question next week. Where is God when hard times hit? And then next week, we'll talk about Nick's question. And we'll talk about Mary's question. Well, they want to come back because they bonded together as a group. And now these are their big issues. So it's exactly what the kind of stuff they want to talk about. Now, this gives you some time during that week to do some research to be able to not just answer Bob's question, but to facilitate a discussion around it. You're not there to preach. You're not there to give a Bible study. You're there to listen to their input, to listen to their opinions, and to gently bring a biblical perspective. And so you just go right down the list, and that becomes your curriculum. People love it. They love these groups. And God uses them. 80% of people come to faith. You can have these groups in your church in no time. Get Gary's book, A to Z, How to Do Them, and you can implement them. Third category, we have seeker services that some churches do. And by the way, I would say that most pastors are not called to do those kind of services. I would readily say that. But I think we can all do seeker groups. And the third category are outreach events. Outreach events. And these can be big or small. They can be what Bill Hybels likes to call Matthew parties. Because when Matthew became a disciple, remember, he threw a party for his non-believing friends to rub shoulders with his Christian friends. And that's what a Matthew party is. You just throw a party and you invite some Christians, you invite some non-Christians, and you trust that God's going to do something in the midst of that. I have a friend named Terry, a woman who worked for the Willow Creek Association. And she had a neighbor named Kathy who was really alienated for some reason from Christianity. And so Terry, before Christmas one year, decided she was going to throw a party. And she was going to tell some Christian friends and non-Christian friends to come and to each bring some little toys and hygiene items and school supplies and some shoe boxes. And they were going to make some shoe boxes that they were going to donate to Samaritan's Purse to be given away in the third world. Well, everybody likes to help third world kids at Christmas. So Christians came, non-Christians came, and Kathy, her neighbor, came. And just being around these Christians and seeing they're normal and doing this thing together sort of got her opened up. And so she was more willing to engage in conversations. Well, by the time Easter came around, that next Easter, Terry invited Kathy to come to Easter services with her. And Kathy said she would. And at that service that Easter, she and her two kids came to Christ. And it all started in a little outreach thing. It's a party with a purpose. We've got certain people in your church are a party waiting to happen. Give them a reason. Give them a purpose for their party. And man, who knows what's going to happen? And then sometimes they're huge events. We did a debate at Willow Creek Church a number of years ago between an atheist and a Christian. We had 7,773 people live on our campus in our auditorium and hooked up by overflow. We had coast-to-coast radio. It was the biggest event I've ever been part of. It was a great time. And, you know, God used it. So, you know, it can be anywhere in between. Let me mention a couple of things to help you in terms of doing outreach events. How many of you have Get Outreach Magazine? Anybody? Yeah, a few of you. This is a wonderful resource, not because I'm a columnist, but because what they do is they talk about what churches are doing around the world as outreaches to their communities. It's just chock full of ideas, how to do stuff, and it tells the story of a church having done an outreach. You can pick up all the how-tos from it. You know, if I were a pastor, I'd get two or three copies of this every time it comes out. It comes out six times a year, and give them to key people in the church. And just pray about, might there be a strategy or an idea in this that we could implement? Just go to outreach.com and it's available. The other thing I hope, how many here are part of a church that's part of the Church Communication Network? Yeah, a few of you. Church Communication Network is a national satellite network that your church can sign up for. It's not expensive at all. They hook you up with the satellite equipment. And we do outreach events several times a year. There's also other stuff, training. You can train your congregation, small group training, all kinds of stuff. They just send down this satellite. I think 52 programs a year. So out every week, there's a new program coming down. But one of the things I'm involved with is creating outreach events for them. So this Sunday night, we're going to do one live from Mariners Church that you were just at. We do a live outreach event on the Da Vinci Code. It's going to go to thousands of churches around North America. They have 3,000 churches hooked up on this thing. And each church, all they have to do is publicize this. We're going to have this outreach event. And Erwin Lutzer from Moody Church and Lee Strobel and Mark Middleburg are going to talk about the Da Vinci Code. And they're going to take questions from the satellite audience. So invite your skeptical friends to come. Just get the biggest screen you've got and set it up. It's like a turnkey outreach event. It's like a no-brainer. And so one of the reasons we did this thing is to say, you know, we can't come to Keokuk, Iowa, or wherever, all these places, and do these outreach events. But we can do them and send them by satellite. And so it's like an easy thing to do. Now, here's what I want to say to wrap this up. When you can combine the big group outreach at like a weekend service with a medium-sized outreach event, with a small group thing, and tie it all together, that's where you really get synergy. Let me give you an example. At Willow Creek recently, which is a seeker service, so we invited the community to come if you're skeptics or not. We started a series on the Da Vinci Code. A lot of interest. In fact, if you've done Da Vinci stuff, you know people show up for this stuff. We set the biggest attendance record at Willow Creek in their new auditorium doing the Da Vinci Code. So people came, and we did. I opened it up, did the first week of the series. But that was the seeker group part, or the seeker service part. But then we said, now, after the service, if you're a spiritual seeker and you have questions that we didn't get to answer, go to our Da Vinci Code room. And I'm going to go down there, and we'll spend another half hour. I'll just answer your questions. So we had lots of people who went to this room. But what did they find when they went into that room? Not chairs set up like a theater, but chairs like you're at tables. And at each table, there was already somebody sitting. It was a person who wants to lead a seeker small group. So when a non-believer came in the room, hey, come on, sit down with me. So I sat at the table, we filled the tables, got to know each other around the tables, and I came up, I did Q&A. But then the key thing happened at the end of the evening where the host at each table said to his table, did you enjoy talking about this stuff? Oh yeah, this was great. Why don't we get together for the next 4 weeks? We got this DVD-driven curriculum that we can talk about the Da Vinci Code. Would you like to do that? Sure, that'd be great. So what did we do? We started with a big event, a seeker service. We brought them to a medium-sized event where people got their questions answered, and then we enfolded them into seeker groups. It's like a funnel. Knowing that 80% of the people who join those groups most likely are going to come to Christ. So, I mean, we did this at Willow Creek a number of years ago where I did a big weekend service on tough questions about Christianity, and we invited everybody to come to a ballroom at a local hotel that night for a similar tough question session. And we have 600 people show up that night at tables like this, and we enfolded 120 people into small groups, knowing that we're probably going to get 100 new believers out of that. So when you can combine those two and use the small groups as a way that's fed by the larger events, what we're doing at Mariners this week, when we do this national satellite broadcast, at Mariners Church, it's going to be tables. And Gary Poole came in last week and he trained a bunch of people how to do seeker groups. So when we do this national satellite broadcast from Mariners, people will come in, they'll sit at these tables, and we're going to enfold them into seeker groups right there. That they'll come back and go through this experience and connect. So, I mean, I just personally think the seeker group thing, if you can create opportunities to enfold people in those experiences, especially in our postmodern world, that's where God seems to be working. The Alpha Course is another example of this. Many of you probably have used it or are familiar with it. That's just another kind of a seeker group. And God's using that all around the planet. So anyway, I think those six steps, they're biblical, they make sense. Where I see pastors really implementing them, I see great evangelistic changes in churches. So, if you want more on those, Mark Middleberg's book, Building Contagious Church, really fleshes out all of those points in much more detail. That's my talk. So, we got a few more minutes for questions, and whatever you want to talk about, that or something else. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for the contagious Christianity.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, the new edition of the Contagious Course, thanks for saying it, by the way. It's just now finished, and it's coming out in a few months. For one thing, we've updated the videos. We've added more racial diversity, more age diversity. It's a little more postmodern. What happened was, in Europe, they created a European edition. They did such a much better job in the videos than we did, that we just sort of took their cues and recreating these videos. They're going to be much more real and dynamic. So that's one thing. We've updated all the examples, all the text is updated. It's a little easier to teach. But the core of it remains the same. And we put everything on PowerPoint as opposed to acetates or whatever they're on now. What's that? Yeah, DVDs, yeah. So thanks, I'm glad you're using it. I can't give you a date. I just know that Mark Middleberg just shipped all the text and everything to Zondervan, so I'm thinking next 6 months or so. Yes, sir. Perfect. Would my book, Case for Faith, be good for a seeker small group? Absolutely. It deals with the eight tough objections to Christianity. And, you know, each what you could do is get together and then just agree to read a chapter for each session, get together and talk about it. And I even have discussion questions in there. So you could turn that into a small group experience. Absolutely. Books are a good way to do that. The book on heaven by Randy Alcorn. You know, people are curious about heaven, and they have a longing in their heart for, you know, heaven, I think, even if they're not believers. And that's a book you could go through together. There's lots of good books that could be done that way. Randy Alcorn. Yeah, Alcorn. My wife's actually using that with her discipleship Christians that she's mentoring. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm not. In fact, I was invited to a preview at Sony, but it was at 3 o'clock, so I couldn't go. But I'll see it tomorrow. Yeah, I've heard that. Of course, the critics in the, at the Cannes Film Festival hated it, but they hated Titanic, and it's the number one grossing film of all time. So, you know, there you go. But I don't know what's going to happen. A lot of the early reviews have been it's long, ponderous, a little boring. That may dampen some enthusiasm for it. But you got when you've got one out of every five Americans has read the book cover to cover. One out of every five Americans read it cover to cover. They're going to want to see the movie. They're just going to want to see it played out. And if they hear, it's not that, they're going to want to see it anyway. So that's frightening. There's going to be 10 million people, it's estimated, who will go to the movie who have not yet read the book. One of the more frightening statistics is that 2 million Americans have changed their spiritual perspective after reading the book. 66% of Britons who've read the book say that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and had children. One out of every three Canadians believes there's descendants of Jesus walking among us today who've read the book. 24% of people in France say that the book is basically historically accurate. And this is a frightening phenomenon. And that's why we did this small group curriculum. And we also did a inexpensive book called, I don't know, I didn't bring it up, but it's a little red covered book called, oh, here it is. Exploring the Da Vinci Code. And the idea behind this is it's inexpensive. You can get it for, you know, $2.50 probably from outreach.com. They have for half price. And then you give it to your congregation, you know, four for $20. So you recover your costs, but you equip them to be able to reach out to people, the waitresses and cab drivers and people on airplanes, and just put a resource into their hand. Say, hey, you know, there's another side to it. Why don't you take this and read it? And so we'll see what happens. I'm excited about the evangelistic opportunity with the Da Vinci Code and praying that God's going to take what has wrought so much ill and turn it around and use it for good. I think he's going to do. 67% of pastors say we are going to respond in some way. They do a series, a sermon, give away resources, do a small group thing or whatever. So that I found that really encouraging. Yes, sir. Yeah, yeah. Has postmodern thinking affected apologetics? You know what the real story. Talk to most postmodern pastors. As one guy put it to me, quote, "There's two things my congregation cannot get enough of: doctrine and apologetics." I said, "You gotta be kidding." He said, "No." I said, "Why?" And he said, "The reason is they've never heard this stuff before. This is all new to them. They never heard it." Now, there is a difference. I did a message. I mentioned earlier this message of my story of coming from atheism to faith and the evidence that convinced me that Christianity is true. I gave that message at Willow Creek Church, which is a boomer church. And, you know, it resonated really well. And it was very interesting. A guy came down afterwards. He said, "That was fascinating stuff. Do you have a book I could read about it?" I took that same message. I did not change one word. I went to a postmodern church, preached the exact same message. They had the biggest response they ever had, and a guy came up to me, and it's just unbelievable. A guy came up to me and said, "Wow, I'd never heard that stuff before. Is there a group I could join to talk about it?" I thought, isn't that a classic? You know, here's the boomer wants to read a book. Here's the, you know, the Gen X guy who wants to get into a conversation, wants a group to participate, wants to discuss it. Now, I will say that one way has changed apologetics also is the way in which apologetics is delivered. When I did the case for Christ, you know, Zondervan said, "Well, we don't expect to sell any of this, but we'll do it because we believe in it." But nobody reads apologetics. It's a category of books. They just don't sell. So that's fine. We think it's an important book. We're going to do it. And I said, "Well, that's fine. I don't care. I did it because I thought God led me to write it." Well, the amazing thing was, not only has it been phenomenal, but the single biggest percentage of people who've come to faith through that book are postmoderns, 16 through 24-year-olds. So what's going on? And I talked about this with Josh McDowell, and he said, "I'll tell you exactly what's going on. What you didn't do in that book is just give a bunch of information and evidence. You told a story. I was an atheist. Here's how I lived. Here's why I began investigating. Here's the evidence that convinced me. Here's how I received Christ. Here I changed my life." You told a story. It's how it's presented. Josh McDowell said to me, I used to preach on college campuses, and I would give all the evidence for Christianity, and people would come to faith, and it was great. And then the numbers of people coming to faith started to go down, 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 down. We said, what's going on here? So now he says, do you know what I do today? I give the same evidence, but I tell the story. My dad was an alcoholic. This is what it was like in my relationship with him. It's very difficult. This is, and he tells his story and integrates the evidence into the story. And now more people are coming to faith than ever. So I think it's how we present apologetics to the postmodern mind. Sometimes it needs to be done differently, but are they interested? Yeah, I believe they are. A good friend of mine, Ken Baugh, was the postmodern pastor at McLean Bible Church in Virginia. And he grew that to like 1,500 kids, and now it's 3,000. Young people, now it's 3,000. But he did something on the Da Vinci Code 2 years ago when he was there, roughly a year and a half ago or whatever it was, when this was just kind of hitting. Huge response from these postmodern kids. And he would get off the stage and he said, I felt like I was getting away with murder. I was teaching them doctrine, church history, and apologetics, and they couldn't get enough. Go figure. Well, they were responding to the Da Vinci Code, which was a story and something that they had connected with and they were intrigued by, and they were getting asked questions by people who raised curiosity in their own mind, and God used it. So I think apologetics is more important than ever. One of the things that I've done, I'm glad you brought this up because I really, really, really wanted to mention this. I'm so excited about this. To deliver the evidence for the faith and doctrine to a new generation and to our generation, I got some guys to fund this so I could do it for free. We've created the largest video-driven apologetics and doctrine website on the internet. We're loading 1,000 video clips of everybody from Josh McDowell to Luis Palau to Rick Warren to me to Hank Hanegraaff to you name it. Max Licato, John Ortberg, we're loading clips, 30 seconds to 10 minutes long, and it's all searchable by keyword. So people, it's got search engines, so a guy can come on and say, resurrection, boom. Here's 20 clips they can choose from and listen to an expert articulate the evidence for the resurrection. Here's something on the Trinity. Here's something on just about any area. And then, of course, the Da Vinci Code, we've already got dozens and dozens and dozens of clips on that. And it's all free. It's called leestrobel.com. So just tell people about it. Go there. Use it yourself, but tell people about it because it's a great place that they can come get free information about. The subtitle of the site is What Christians Really Believe and Why. Because you know what's going to happen, friends? Dan Brown made $41 million last year. It is open season on Jesus. Look at the bestseller list. What is the number one religion book in America today? Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman, which attacks the reliability of the New Testament. What's the number six best-selling religion book in America? The End of Faith, which argues that faith in and of itself is illegitimate and needs to be eradicated from our culture. It's the sixth biggest religion-selling book in America. The Jesus Papers, the Jesus Dynasty. These are books that attack the core of Christianity. Next 2 years, that's just the beginning. Because it's open season on Jesus. We've got to equip our people to have a place to go when they get a question, to just type in a word and get some expert that can give them some down-to-earth, practical information to help set the record straight. So